This is the Jon Favreau's My Daddy podcast with Jessica Garcia and Monica Montoya.
Hello.
Oh.
Hi, Monica.
Hello, Jessica.
How are you?
I'm swell. I have my cup of coffee. I have my skull. I have my crackers, my alphabet crackers. I'm happy.
Me too.
These also, are the things in life.
It's Halloween today.
It is me, skull and bones.
Monica's holding up a skull while she says that.
As if I was Mr. Hamlet himself. It is I, Mr. Hamlet and my skull, smaller Hamlet Jr. And we recite songs and also poems and soliloquies in the moonlight. And we say, to be or not to be. And we honestly debate everything from crescent to life. So follow us in our journey beyond the Halloween times. Once again, I'm Mr. Hamlet, and this is Mr. Hamlet, smaller Hamlet Jr.
Where did Monica? Where's my co-host?
I don't know where she went. Monica!
Hello?
Monica?
Monica?
It is I.
Oh, she's back.
I'm back.
I missed you for a minute there.
I had Mr. Hamlet come on and help us out.
That's nice. He's a nice surprise guest.
He's a nice man. It's Halloween!
It is Halloween
it's
today.
It's the same as every other day in the quarantine times.
And while this is not a Halloween episode, it is being recorded on Halloween.
I know. It's nice that we're at least doing like one Halloween
movie.
Yeah,
we do have one Halloween movie.
It just happens to be a movie that Jack Nicholson's in.
Yes. And that is who the guest today. The guest? He's not here.
Our guest, Jack Nicholson. Hi.
He comes out for nobody but this podcast.
He doesn't
even go to Laker games ever anymore. But he comes on this podcast.
A niche Jack Nicholson fans. You know where to find him.
He loves it.
Friend of the pod.
But yeah, so today we're talking about Jack Nicholson. We kind of picked three films sort of at random out of his filmography. How do you feel
which
about
is
this?
Incredibly extensive, by the way. Jack Nicholson.
Very extensive.
I mean, he's an immense. I was going to say an American treasure, but I don't know where the accent came from. He's an American treasure.
Sure. Yes.
And there is nothing that he has done that I don't like.
No, he's incredible. I definitely think we'll do another episode or more.
Maybe more.
On him in the future. I just didn't feel inclined to do like a multi-parter right now.
Jack Nicholson is one of those like daddies that has an insane filmography.
Yeah.
So like there's a daddy, you know, like Daniel Day-Lewis, right? He's made like one film. And then he became
like
a cobbler.
10, but yeah.
And then he became a cobbler. Jack Nicholson did not become a cobbler. He's been acting since he was a young man.
Yeah.
And now he's an old man and he's still acting. Not to be confused with Gary Oldman.
Well, he's not still acting. The last thing he was in was like 10 years ago.
No. He's still acting. Go to his house. Watch him perform his skits.
Have you been to the private theater that
of
he does?
Of course
there?
I have. Oh. Friend of the pod, remember?
I'm not. I don't get invited, so he must
he
like
does,
you more.
So, you know what's so funny is Jackie. We call him Jackie. He does these incredible skits around Thanksgiving time. It's like,
Pilgrims. So you're
going to
be heading over there soon?
Kind of. I didn't get invited this year, but like, you know what I mean? Like,
it's
crazy.
It's probably just because of COVID.
It's because of COVID. Yeah. It really is. Anyway. Moving on.
But yeah, he has so many movies that we were just like, we can't even arrange these, but like by genre, we can't arrange these by time period. So let's just pick three that we like and then we'll do
Move
more
on.
Later.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll start with a little bit of background info.
Background
on our boy Jack Nicholson is arguably one of the biggest daddies around.
Not the biggest in terms of size, the biggest in terms of scope
and talent. He first came to Hollywood in 1954 when he was 17 and took a job as an office worker for Hanna-Barbera, where he was offered a job as an animator, but he declined because he wanted to be an actor. How cute. He then made his film debut in 1958 in The Crybaby Killer, playing the title role. But it wasn't until 1969 when he got his big break in Easy Rider, giving him his first Oscar nomination.
Woo!
After his role in 1970's Five Easy Pieces and his second Oscar nomination, Jack was officially considered a leading man and an American anti-hero.
Ooh.
Frequently being compared to Marlon Brando and James Dean. Since then, Jack's career has skyrocketed. His talent has earned him 17 Golden Globe nominations with 6 wins, 3 SAG Award nominations with 1 win, 7 BAFTA nominations with 3 wins, 1 Grammy win, and 12 Academy Award nominations with 3 wins, making him the most nominated male performer in the acting categories. He's also a daddy to 5 children.
Whoa.
That's a lot.
That was a fucking mouthful, Jessica. Damn.
You know, he's highly decorated.
He's
and regarded.
Incredible. Z. C. First of all, I fucking love that he has so many fucking nominations and like minimal wins in each category.
Yeah. But he got nominated and won that one Grammy though.
I know.
He really brought it home.
he really came through with the Grammy win.
Yeah, yeah.
He really said, all right, I'm throwing this out there. I'm throwing it down. I'm laying down these tracks. It's me, Jackie N.
I think he read like the audiobook of a children's story or something.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's what
it was. Can you imagine Jack Nicholson like in the studio?
No, I can't.
Because I really cannot. All right. A little background on The Shining. The Shining. 1980, directed by Stanley Kubrick, written by Stanley Kubrick and Diane Johnson, based on the novel by Stephen King, an iconic novel. Speaking of novels, a novelist, Jack Torrance, played by Jack Nicholson, takes a job interview as a winter caretaker of the isolated, old, huge, and beautiful Overlook Hotel. Jack brings his wife, Wendy, played by Shelley Duvall, and his son, Danny. It happens that Danny has a mysterious power known as The Shining. Danny meets Halloran, the hotel cook, in their first day arriving at the Overlook, who warns them about the hotel and the sinister room 237. As the days go by, Danny has visions. Meanwhile, Jack starts diving into insanity, turning more and more aggressive at the point that Danny and Wendy get convinced that Jack might try to do something terrible.
Terrible. And something terrible he tries to do. So they were right.
He tries to fucking murder them.
Yep. Pretty bad. Pretty gnarly.
You know the like opening track, the opening beat?
Yeah, yeah.
The fat beat. It's like, bum, 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 bum.
Yep, that's
bum.
The one.
The fucking sick beat. It slaps so hard.
This is one of those movies where like I don't find it that scary to me, to me at least.
Yeah.
But like the score is what makes it scary.
It makes it so scary.
I was like, when I was watching it, I had seen it once before, but not in a long time. And so when I was watching it this time, I was like, I think if I like turned off the sound, I would feel fine.
I agree.
Watching this.
I agree. I just want to point out the fact that like if I remember correctly, like one of the opening shots is just like them driving up the fucking mountain. Mm-hmm. And like, that's it. Nothing scary is happening, but you feel like you want to fucking vomit because it's just like, bah, bah, bah.
Yeah, and then it gets that really like high pitched sound happening.
It's fucking terrible.
I don't like it.
I just want to first acknowledge and talk about the hotel.
Yes.
It's gorgeous. Beautiful. It is a beautiful, like, I wouldn't say like it's a ski lodge, but it's like a, just a beautiful like paradise. Mm-hmm. It's got these gorgeous windows, these insane like 70s floor, like the carpet.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't realize that like they used totally different sets for everything. That,
I know.
Like the outside of the hotel is just this random place in Oregon.
I know.
I mean, it's not random. It's a hotel.
I was going to say like, we're not trying to shade the hotel or anything.
And then everything else is just like sets. But the fucking interiors are crazy
stunning.
They're so fucking good.
It almost makes me sad that like all the blood gets everywhere.
I know, it is kind of sad.
I remember when Halloween Horror Nights did like one of their mazes was like a Shining maze. And at that point in time, I had like very recently seen The Shining. Mm-hmm. And they included like a bunch of you know the scene where Jack Torrance like walks, is outside with the axe and he's fucking all crazy looking and mm-hmm. he's like walking through all those hedges that are like littered with snow.
Yeah, the maze.
The maze. It's amazing. And they had that and they had just a bunch of like Jack Torrances running around with like axes in the middle of this like, it's Los Angeles. It doesn't fucking snow.
But in a snowy maze.
And that sounds scary. It wasn't terrifying.
I don't like, I've never been to Halloween Horror Nights, but don't plan on ever going.
Oh.
Sounds scary.
It was not scary. That's what I'm trying to say is it was not scary. I think it was just the music.
For you, I think.
And I think maybe his face. I think maybe his face was scary. Jack Nicholson does this thing in The Shining and in other films where he like bares his teeth.
Yeah, that's like his thing where he raises his eyebrows.
And he bares
his teeth. It makes him look very like primal.
It makes him look very primal. It's very aggressive. Yeah. But like, even if his body's not doing anything, when he makes that face, it's, you can kind of like see, you know how when a shark is like about to kill someone, mm-hmm. its eyes like turn black?
Yeah.
It's very like akin to that.
Yeah. And then he also tends to like very quickly go from that to this like dropping his face.
Yeah.
Which is equally horrifying.
Equally terrifying. He does it a lot in The Shining. Yeah, he does it a lot like throughout a lot of his different films for different reasons, obviously. But
yeah,
it always elicits the same reaction of like, ugh.
Well, that's one of the things that like one of the big points I have about his acting in this movie, because I mean, you know, it's not 2020. It was made 40 years ago. But yeah, he had still had an extensive career at that point. Mm-hmm. Like, people, for the most part, knew who he was and he had a reputation. Yeah. Like, he was quickly becoming, like, you know, a Meryl.
Meryl.
And yet, like, he has such a reputation and he's so recognizable, and yet he stays fresh and, like, so believable in every single role. It's just really, really impressive, especially in a movie like this where like the horror, a lot of it isn't like visual.
Agreed.
I mean, some of the shock value for the audience but what he himself is going through at the beginning, at least, none of it is visual.
No.
It's all mental. And so to still be able to see his like descent into madness is really fucking scary, but also like really impressive.
It's very impressive. I know like, me watching the film and only sort of like, because obviously for this time around, I only had to look at Jack Nicholson's performance. Mm-hmm. Only seeing him, it was like a very different experience from just taking in the movie as a whole. Simply because Jack Nicholson is not very scary in the beginning. Mm-hmm. He's really not. He's you know, he might not be like a stand-up guy, right? Like sure. His character. But he has a sort of like innocence to him. And for Jack Nicholson and only Jack Nicholson to be able to pour into the character and create these instances where he is diving into madness,
yeah,
and the things around him might not be, I think that is a testament to his abilities as an actor. Because if you took Jack Nicholson and like mm-hmm. placed him in like in a black box and took away like all the sets and you just played the movie from the beginning to the end, like, it's still a really fucking scary film because it's just within him, and it's in his face and it's in his eyes and it's in the way that like you'll notice that like he starts like hunching over a little bit like throughout the whole movie, like as it progresses.
Yeah. And then he like gets that kind of limp.
He gets that kind of limp and like he looks visceral and like primal and really aggressive and scary. Mm-hmm. And that comes from just him from the beginning until the end.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I freaking love him in this film. I think that he makes this film. I mean, I also love Shelley Duvall.
She's incredible.
She's so good.
She's so good. I do think she doesn't serve a huge purpose.
I know, but that was, like, you know, she's not given a whole lot, but in the 80s, it's fine.
But yeah, she is amazing. Something that I was impressed with both of them is that like you're not given a whole lot of idea of who they are as people,
right?
Like, quite frankly, at the beginning you're like, I don't know who they are.
No,
like, I don't know what they're like. I don't know what their personalities are like. Like, you know, very, very little. And yet you also know that they're that Jack Nicholson is transitioning into something else. Mm-hmm. And because of his transition, Shelley Duvall is then turning into a sort of different person because she has to react, obviously, to her husband.
Yeah, she cries a lot more.
Exactly, and screams and is like genuinely terrified. So like, even though you have pretty much no foundation of who they are as people, you still realize that something is shifting and it's something really bad, which I think is really difficult to do. Yes. I think in a lot of movies that wouldn't work because you're like, well, like, we can't judge the shift because we don't know where we started.
Right.
You know, but here that is the case, but it's still so fucking drastic that it's terrifying.
It's believable.
Yeah.
Which makes it terrifying. Word on the street is Shelley Duvall cried so much that she fucking ran out of tears.
Oh my God.
She literally had to have like a million water bottles around her at all times. So she was just chugging them constantly so she would be able to cry for Mr. Cooper.
Oh, poor Shelley.
Oh, sweet lady.
She was so good though. Her little Southern accent.
I know. Her little Southern accent. Danny. Danny. Jack, don't kill me, Jack.
Wow, is this has Shelley Duvall come onto the pod?
Shelley Duvall.
It's not even that good of a
Doc,
an impression. It's just
Doc.
Really funny.
Doc. Doc.
Oh my God. Oh. Anyway, another thing that I really, really liked about his performance is that, like, you can still see moments where, like, him as a father comes through, even though he's fully, like, the devil.
Absolutely.
At certain times.
He is fully the horny devil.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, so, like, he has horns.
Like, there's that scene where he's talking to Danny on the bed, mm-hmm. and he starts telling him that they're gonna stay there forever.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's really creepy.
Yes.
But he's still being, like, very paternal.
Yeah.
I just think it's really interesting that obviously he and the writers made the choice for that to be present because, you know, there are lines that show that as well. But you can also see it in his physicality, in his body, and just how he relates in space to Danny.
Right. They coexist.
Yeah, exactly.
The father and the what, demon devil forest thing.
Exactly.
They're pals.
Daddy devil. But yeah, I like that a lot. I thought that was a really great part. And obviously it eventually leaves him because at one point he's just like, no, I'm going to fucking kill my kid. But
casual. It's casual. I mean, a lot of the times people really credit like Stanley Kubrick for the entirety of the film. Uh-huh. And I get that. I mean, a director has to have a vision and they have to execute it really well and make sure everyone else is on board. And
yeah.
I think in terms of this movie, though, the bulk of the work was done by the actors.
Yeah.
I think Jack Nicholson and especially Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall, I think like they carried this film like on their backs.
Yeah.
Because it would not be the film that it is without Jack Nicholson's performance.
No.
And then Shelley Duvall acting alongside him and opposite him.
Well, especially because the writers, you know, Stanley Kubrick and
the other one,
what's her name? And Diane Johnson. Yeah. They changed a lot of the story from the book. And I know some people get mad about that, but
some people really like it. I'm a fan.
I've never read the book, so I can't, you know, attest to that. But I think I think even though they made such big changes to like the actual story, mm-hmm. the characters were still consistent, which mm-hmm. means that the core of the story was still consistent.
Exactly.
So it didn't really end up mattering, in my opinion.
Exactly. Which is why it does not bother me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's down to the acting in a lot of ways. I mean, clearly they were directed well. But you know, they had to bring it. And a lot of this shit is really hard to do, like
over and over and over again.
Like watching that scene with Jack Nicholson where he goes to the bar for the first time.
Oh my God.
And he just fucking monologues for like
50 years.
Yeah, for like 7 minutes or something like that, which is a very long time to be monologuing. And he has such drastic shifts in like his insanity.
Right. Just in those like 7 minutes.
Yeah, in his facial expression and his body, in like how quick he's talking. It's crazy. And I can imagine how exhausting that is to do as an actor. Not to mention that the movie is physically exhausting.
Right. I mean, just, I mean, think about how meticulous this movie had to be because of its director, yeah. Right? Stanley Kubrick has a really specific reputation.
Yeah.
And then being, I mean, you have to be a fucking pro to handle all of that, mm-hmm. and to be able to take that direction and to do it over and over and over again and be treated in such a visceral way and having to do things really consistently every single time. It's like putting these actors in an incubator of perfection. It's like it really messes them up. I know that I've read several interviews with Shelley Duvall and Jack Nicholson, and both of them were like, that was the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my entire life.
Yeah.
Like, period. Point blank, period. Especially Shelley Duvall being who she was. She just, like, a lot of the time she felt almost like singled out by Stanley Kubrick, mm-hmm. and like that she had to give, if Jack Nicholson gave 100%, she had to give 120%.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, obviously part of that had to be she was a woman and she wasn't necessarily the lead.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that a lot of it, I think movies like this can be made not like basically destroying your actors.
Yeah.
I think that that's possible. Forgive me.
I don't know.
I'm sorry, you wouldn't know, Jessica.
I wouldn't know. I don't know. Because on the one hand, like, sure, their talent should speak for itself in a way. But also, like, the story is about being pushed to the ends of your, you know,
limits.
Yeah, being pushed to your limits. I don't know if you can do that on your own.
I agree.
Sometimes. I think a lot of times you do need an external force. I wasn't on the set. I don't know what goes on.
Well, I was on the set. I was on the set of The Shining and on the set of The Exorcist and on the set of Poltergeist. So I would know. I would know.
I'm a ghost.
No, I think, I just think that talking about this movie and talking about specifically like the amount of effort that Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall put in.
Yeah.
I think it warrants a conversation about like whether like the limits that specifically like actors have to go to in order to produce a work of perfection.
Sure.
The Shining is considered to be a near perfect film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so is Back to the Future and E.T., but whatever. It's fine. All is well. And they don't got axes in them, so, you know. Or like,
but this maces. Does have axes in it.
I was gonna say,
also talk about like truly the scariest weapon in the world,
an axe.
Because like at first you're like, it can't be that scary, it can't get me from a distance, but like that shit's aggressive.
If you swang it, you gotta swang it really good.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, obviously there's the iconic scene where he's like whacking the fucking door, yeah. and the camera's like following the axe the whole
yes,
time.
It's so
and
good.
It's, it just whips back and forth. I'm like, you can't see
Monica's
me.
Demonstrating it.
It's like every time he's like meh, and the camera goes wah, and he goes bang, and the camera goes and then he keeps hitting the door and like chopping it open. And yeah. Word on the street is they use like fucking 60 or 70 doors and did it like 60 that. Or 70 times. But you know, and he fucking finally breaks it open and is like, here's Johnny. It's fucking terrifying. I don't care how many times that like clip is played at like the Universal lot or whatever, wherever it's played. I don't care how many times it's played. It's still fucking scary. An yes. axe is a scary weapon.
An axe is a really scary weapon, especially because like, oh my God, I was putting myself in Shelley Duvall's shoes in that tiny bathroom.
Oh my God.
She can't open the window enough to crawl out and she just has to sit there and watch this fucking axe come at her. Oh my God.
Can you imagine?
No.
Can you imagine
no,
being
I
in that
can't.
Situation?
I cannot imagine.
Shelley. Jack. Why?
But then he just, you know, It's funny because it's like it was such a kind of like, I guess fast, but also sort of slow.
It was a slow burn, I would say.
Slow burn.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it just fucking ends.
I know.
And it just very quickly like cuts to him dead in the snow. And you're like, okay.
All right. Thanks for the relief. Thanks for that.
Cool. Thank you. And he just freezes to death.
What a way to go. You know, watching him freeze to death.
I mean, didn't watch it. We just saw the product.
But I thought to myself, ah, yes, this is hell freezing over. This is what that is.
Yeah, I guess literally, you're right.
Literally. I never understood that phrase like, oh, I'll do it when hell freezes over.
It's because it'll never happen.
But it happened. But it happened.
In The Shining.
In The Shining.
Oh my God.
In The Shining, Shining. You can cut it now. We're done. In The Shining. God. We're all in The Shining now.
Oh boy.
Sorry.
That was The Shining.
That was The Shining. That was Jack Nicholson.
In The Shining. So now we're going to move to 17 years later.
What a fucking time jump.
I fucking love this movie.
This is one of my personal, like, this is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah.
The first time I watched it, I was a wee lad. So what movie is it? Yaisika?
This is As Good As It Gets. 1997, directed by James L. Brooks, written by Mark Andrus and James L. Brooks.
Icons. Icons only.
Melvin Udall. What a name. Monica just did a spit take. Oh my God. Melvin Udall, played by Jack Nicholson. It is a ridiculous name. A cranky, bigoted, obsessive, compulsive writer is rude to everyone he meets, including his gay neighbor Simon, played by Greg Kinnear. But when he has to look after Simon's dog, whose name is Verdell.
Verdell.
He begins to soften and, if still not completely over his problems, finds he can conduct a relationship with the only waitress, played by Helen Hunt, at the local diner who will serve him. So, yes, this is As Good As It Gets.
This is As Good As It Gets. I saw this when I was like 10, mm-hmm. and I didn't really understand a lot of what was going on.
It's a pretty complicated film.
It has a really complicated, the relationships between all the characters are really fucking complicated.
Yeah, it's difficult to understand like why they are the way they are.
Yeah.
And why they relate to each other the way they do.
But it was a really good introduction for me on like OCD and like, why, like, how deeply can affect people, like, mm-hmm. it can change your entire personality.
Sure.
And I think it's a really good, maybe not a good representation of like all, you know, all aspects of OCD.
Sure, because he's pretty mild in the grand scheme of things. Yeah.
But I think that it's a good representation of how mental illness can affect your life and can change who you are fundamentally if you're not able to get a handle on it.
Totally.
So watching it kind of like had that effect on me. So it's been like a really, like, I've been very fond of this movie for a very long time. I'm also very into, I'm a big like Animal Actors fan.
Jill the dog is A+.
I would love the dog's autograph.
Sadly, that dog is probably passed.
I know, it's probably passed on. This was 1997. Dogs live for maybe 16 years at the most.
But that does mean that Jill the dog might have been alive within the past decade.
That's true. Jill the dog. Pour one out for Jill the dog.
If you knew Jill the dog.
If you know any of Jill the dog's descendants.
Yeah. Hit us up. Maybe we'll want to adopt.
Anyway, I'm just a big like Animal Actors advocate.
No,
big
totally. Fan.
Dr. Doolittle blew me away.
This was 10 out of 10 animal acting in this movie.
Uh-huh.
I think second only to the dog in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh yeah. Excellent animal actor.
Absolutely incredible.
Best actor in the whole movie, honestly.
Maybe. Okay, back to As Good As It Gets. This movie, this is not the first time in Jack Nicholson's career where he's like an anti-hero, because mm-hmm. that's what his whole fucking career is built on.
That's him. That's
but
who
I
he
think
is.
That this movie is a really very clear-cut example of that and his acting style. Because at this point he's super seasoned. You know, it's 1997.
Oh, he's seasoned, all right.
But Melvin Udall is just like this deplorable fucking human being. And yet, you're so captivated by him and so interested in him the whole time. I just want to like know more, even though he's absolutely horrible. And like, racist and homophobic.
So racist, so homophobic. Like, you watch this and you think, how am I supposed to like this guy? I love that, like, the two sides to him are this fucking insane. I mean, I wouldn't say insane because he actually has, like, OCD, but he's just, like, so wild and, like, angry and mean, and he's a bigot and he's a racist and he and he's a homophobe, and yet he's able to pull off these incredible romantic moments and deliver this, like, sweep you off your feet, like, mentality, and it's believable. And he has these two really glorious sides to him where he's so deep as a character that you want to know more. And the second that you fall all the way in, you realize that he's a person, like a real human fucking being with feelings. And he's lonely and he's sad. And he knows that the way that he treats people is not always okay.
Yeah, that's, I think that's one of the really, really impressive parts of this story, first of all, because a character like that is not easy to write. But also part of his performance, because a character like this is also not easy to act, is that, like, you know, you can see his shame a lot of the time. You can see that he knows that people are not responding well to his behavior or what he's doing. But it's almost like he's just, like, he's so used to being this way that it's almost easier, and he just writes it off as, like, this is just me,
like the default. Right, but it's easier.
But he knows that it's wrong, and he knows that people actively dislike him and that he's saying rude shit, but he still does it. But it's really, really interesting how, like, we talk all the time about acting with the eyes. You can still see in his eyes that, like, he knows what he's doing.
Absolutely.
He knows that people don't like him.
Not only that, but, like, in all the scenes where he's in the diner, and the empathy that Carol shows him really kind of throws him for a loop sometimes. And it's almost, like, expected, right? Like, a lot of what his character is like, somewhat like a barking dog almost. And the barking dog only stops when it gets fed.
Yeah.
And the thing about Jack Nicholson is, again, like, with the eyes, right? We're always talking about the actors with the eyes. Actors who know how to act with eyes. You can see that a lot of the times he's fighting that internal struggle of trying to not let his illness overcome him.
Yeah.
While at the same time, wanting to be better, but not thinking that he actually can be.
Yeah.
So the empathy and the compassion that he gets from Carol throughout the entire film, honestly, because she's kind of his only real, quote unquote, friend. He doesn't have any other friends. You can tell that he really struggles with that because he doesn't know, like, sort of, like, where to place her affection or where to place her compassion or where to place her empathy, because a lot of the times you see him, like, almost, like, give in to his illness because it's so big in his brain that he has nowhere else to go. Like, you can see him get so uncomfortable in the diner when, like, his seat's not there for him, or he forgot his silverware, or the food's not right, or he doesn't get the same waitress every time. Like, something's wrong, and you can tell that it's really fucking bothering him.
Yeah. I think the reason why I'm so fascinated by their dynamic and why I love Helen Hunt in this so much is because she's the only person in the movie who will, like, call him on his bullshit.
Yeah.
And challenge him to be a better person on top of it. Because up until this point, like, yeah, he gets into fights with Greg Kinnear. Yeah, he gets into fights with Cuba Gooding Jr. But, like, nobody turns around and says, I know that you can be different.
Right. They don't see that he has any sort of potential. They just say, like, you are who you are and that fucking sucks ass. Mm-hmm. Like, why are you the way that you are?
Exactly. And she doesn't understand him. But she also knows that, like, there's no way that this person is only this.
No.
Which I think that character dynamic was able to bring out something really, really lovely in his acting performance.
Oh, totally. Not only that, but, like, Carol,
a.k.a. Helen Hunt.
A.k.a. Helen Hunt. In this film, she has a son who I think has, like, really severe asthma. And, like, he can't breathe all the time. And I think that a lot of what her character is based on is kind of just, like, survival. And I think, like, beneath the layers and layers of, like, survival and being a caretaker is this, like, this woman who is incredibly lonely and, like, wants wants someone to be there for her. And so I think with her character, it really surprises her when she figures out kind of throughout the film that she is low-key in love with Jack Nicholson's character.
Yeah, which is really interesting.
It is very, very interesting, which is why I wanted to bring it up, because I don't... While it is believable,
sure,
I don't necessarily think it was the only way to end the movie.
I also don't think that.
I don't necessarily think that it needed to happen that way. Even though they're obviously, because they're incredible actors, Jack Nicholson and Helen Hunt, they have incredible chemistry together. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think that that was like the way.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why it ended that way is because he is a romance writer.
Absolutely.
And yet he has no romance in his life. Mm-hmm. So it's a lovely sort of like bow on top of the present for his story to end in love.
Romance.
However, Carol has this whole thing about, she says it over and over again, like, why can't I just have a normal boyfriend?
Right.
Why can't I just find like a normal fucking guy? And you know, I feel that, Carol. not like in my own life. I mean, like, I understand what she means. Like, and so why couldn't she have just had a normal boyfriend?
Of course, she fell in love.
Is my question, like, why did that have to happen?
Of course, it was Melvin.
of course, it was Melvin Udall.
Cuba Gooding Jr. plays the character Simon's agent.
Yeah, his art agent,
which I just find so fucking funny because he's so like sassy in this film. Yes. And he's like, fuck you, you're gonna take care of this guy because it's your fucking fault. And then because Simon in the movie, he is a gay man who lives across the hall from Jack Nicholson's character, mm-hmm, Melvin, and obviously Jack Nicholson is incredibly homophobic and yes, is constantly like berating him, mm-hmm, and you know, talking shit about him and his dog. He has this like adorable little dog, which you already talked about, Jill the dog.
Verdell. What are we gonna do about Verdell?
And unfortunately, Simon is the victim of a hate crime. He gets beat up
by Skeet Ulrich.
The names in this movie fuck me up.
By Skeet Ulrich of Scream fame.
So he gets beat up, and the sort of like the blame, so to speak, kind of falls on everyone's shoulders for not necessarily like taking good care of him. He's alone. Mm-hmm. He's kind of alone in the world, and almost invisible to anyone who isn't like an artist or a friend, mm-hmm, especially his parents. And I think that, you know, Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character, who again is Simon's art agent man, mm-hmm, immediately gives Verdell to Melvin and, mm-hmm, is like, take care of this dog. You better take care of Simon. This is your responsibility now because you're his neighbor and that's what neighbors fucking do, you asshole. Mm-hmm. And I love Cuba Gooding Jr. in that moment with Jack Nicholson, because only Cuba Gooding Jr. could make Jack Nicholson look like a fucking idiot. Because Jack Nicholson is just standing there like with his dick in his head being like, what?
And then on top of it, it's just so much funnier because he does end up forming this like truly adorable relationship with this dog.
Yeah, he to the point where when he has to give the dog back to Simon, mm-hmm, he's like emotionally like unable to.
Yeah,
he has a really hard time like coping with that.
Yeah, which is why it's so great that they eventually move in together. I think this is one of Greg Kinnear's best performances as well. I love him as an actor, but this character Simon is just so sweet and so like othered by the world, and he's someone who just like genuinely doesn't see how people can have bad in them, which is why when he encounters Jack Nicholson, he's so just like, he's very like stumped by him because he's just like, how can you be as mean as, mm-hmm, you are?
Yeah.
But then eventually they bond over, I think, like their otherness, because society has kind of othered them in a lot of ways. And I do think that the presence of Greg Kinnear makes Jack Nicholson like want to be a better person.
Yeah.
Because he sees how like Helen Hunt responds to Simon.
Mm-hmm. And he wants that. And he goes, well, he's a nice guy. And she responds really well to how nice he is. So maybe I should be better.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that Jack Nicholson in this film, like just as an actor with his performance, he's so generous because there are so many fucking stars in this film.
Yeah.
Like not a lot of people talk about this film very often. And I think that this is like kind of, I wouldn't necessarily call it an ensemble cast because Jack Nicholson is very much the lead.
Yeah.
But I do think like, he's very generous with the people around him in terms of like his giving as an actor and people are able to like bounce off of him really well. And he's able to bounce off of those actors really, really well. And I think that whoever fucking cast this movie was a fucking genius and they all are so seasoned. They're all like seasoned fucking pros and they all totally bounce off of each other so well and compliment each other in the areas like in the crevices that they don't have something, they like give it to the other actor. It's really cool to watch these actors like work with each other, and especially Jack Nicholson being the lead, how he responds to all of them and like takes it all in and like gives everything back. It's really fucking cool.
I think that a lot of people think it's a given to watch a movie and be like, oh, I'm going to believe that these characters are these people.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it's not all no, the time. No,
it's really hard.
it's hard sometimes to separate the actor from the character, or rather to not separate the actor from the character, to believe that they are one person in that moment. And this movie, no question.
No.
They all just like slip so seamlessly into those roles. And it's a long movie, but it's really, really rewarding.
Yeah, it is 2.5 hours long. But I will say, like, if you're going to watch any of these Jack Nicholson films, I would honestly say, like, please watch As Good As It Gets. Just so you can see, like, I think that this is a really incredible representation of the range that he has within just even a single story. Like, just within a single film. Like, he has incredible range. That you don't necessarily see in a bunch of different films, because he would be like a character actor or he's like the anti-hero. This is very much like, I think like the essence of what Jack Nicholson can do is in this film.
Yeah. I also think they all got Oscar nominations for this.
Oh, fuck yeah. The other thing that I will say about this film before we wrap up this film is I fucking love the score. The score it's in really this good. Film is I rarely like think of a lot of the times, like when I'm like listening to a score, sometimes I'll compare it to like this score because I think that I think the score is by Hans Zimmer. It's brilliant. I think it embodies like the like whimsy that that the film sort of like exhibits, and then also has like a really serious romantic quality to it. And also makes me feel like New York, like this is New York. Like it's really nice. It's a really good score.
No, totally. I think you really nailed it with how to describe the movie in general, is that like it is a very real story, not in the sense that it's like something that would happen to you, but like these people are very like as real as you can get. And as yet there real. Is like there is an element of like whimsy and play to the whole thing. That is really, really fun. And it's just a really rewarding watch.
I always thought that this could make a really great play. It's got that feel.
I think if you could pare down the locations, it feels very theatrical in how the characters are and how they speak to each other.
And they're very, like, there's so much depth to them that I feel like an in-person experience with actors playing these characters would be very rewarding because the film is so rewarding.
I agree.
Enough gushing about As Good As It Gets. All right, ladies and gentlefish. Crusty crew, all folks, let's talk about the dark horse of these three. Let's talk about Jack Nicholson as a senior citizen in love in the Hamptons.
In a rom-com. In a Nancy Myers rom-com.
And you see his ass. Yeah, so
you see Jack Nicholson's bare buns.
Let's talk about Something's Gotta Give.
Let's take it away, Monica.
2003, baby. The year of the rom-com. Written and directed by Nancy Myers. Harry Sanborn, played by Jack Nicholson, is a 63-year-old music industry executive with a fondness for younger women, like Marin, played by Amanda Peet, his latest trophy girlfriend. Things get a little awkward when Harry suffers a heart attack at the home of Marin's mother, Erica, played by the beautiful, the illustrious Diane Keaton.
The queen.
Left in the care of Erica and his doctor, Julian, played by Keanu fucking Reeves, a love triangle starts to take shape.
I want to, because I don't want to harp too much on Keanu Reeves in the discussion of this movie. Keanu Reeves is not good in this movie.
No.
But, this is a big but, he's absolutely entertaining as fuck. I love him in this movie, and I feel that that's kind of how Keanu Reeves' entire career is that he's not that great on a technical level, but God is he enjoyable.
God is he entertaining. God is he handsome.
Ooh, so especially in this movie.
In this movie, so the way that I see it, he does what he's supposed to do in this movie.
Yeah,
which is all you can really ask. Which is all you can really ask of Keanu Reeves in 2003. Like,
or ever.
The setting, they're in the Hamptons, they're in a house bigger than like the fucking United States of America.
It's a huge Hamptons house, and also the opening sequence of this movie is like fucking iconic.
Truly.
Anytime I hear that song, the come my lady, come, yep, come my lady,
yep,
I think of this movie.
This is the movie.
Because it's just a fucking montage of hot women walking around New York.
Yep.
And then Jack Nicholson's creepy voiceover comes on and he just goes,
the younger woman. This has been what I've been doing for the past 40 years, is dating younger women. First of all, what an incredible premise. You don't necessarily see like older love stories very often.
No.
To like an older women and an older man or older people falling in love in their old age. You don't see that.
Leave it
very
to Nancy Meyers. She's done it a couple times and it's true. Incredible.
And every single time she hits the nail right on the head.
Nails it.
In this movie, Jack Nicholson plays like this music man. He plays the music man.
He's the music man.
The music man. The music man. And he marries Marion, the librarian. No, but he's with this girl named Marin, who happens to be the daughter of Diane Keaton's character, Erica, mm-hmm, Berry, who is a playwright who lives in the Hamptons.
She's apparently the most successful fucking playwright in the world. Of all time. Because last I heard, being in theater didn't get you that much money.
No. Which is so fucking funny
to
me.
Maybe she's supposed to be like the Lin-Manuel Miranda of her time.
I really don't think that's the case, my friend.
Okay, I'm just trying to figure out a way in which she could have as much money as she does.
And her husband's like a theater director, so you know like he don't got money. Mm-hmm. So like, it's just one of those things where you sort of have to let it go.
Suspend your disbelief.
You have to suspend your disbelief. But anyway, regardless, she has like writer's block and is like really uptight, mm-hmm, and was just divorced. And she has like, in her own Diane Keaton way, is very like, neurotic and, mm-hmm, also uptight at the same time, which I find to be very jarring. Like, she's a very jarring character.
Yeah.
And Diane Keaton plays her very well. And is both ballsy and also incredibly conservative and reserved.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Nicholson is obviously like this really fucking skeevy dude. He is just constantly like on the prowl for, yeah, young women.
He's just got like this super cool but weird sex appeal, which I feel like has always been his brand.
That's
his fucking brand. 84 years old and he still has this like weird something.
It's so bizarre. I think it's like, I would describe it as more of like a magnetism than,
yeah,
anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I wouldn't even describe it as like sex appeal. I would literally just call it like he has like a magnetism to it.
Yeah,
to him.
He has the most insane like charisma.
Yes.
It's crazy.
Anyway, they sort of like, the reason why they like, the reason why they even cross paths is because he's dating her daughter,
yes,
right?
Amanda Peet, who I think is probably like 35 years younger than him.
So young. So young. And the fucker has like a heart attack.
Yeah, so they're about to fuck, kind of.
Well,
kind they're
of.
Fooling around.
Well, yeah, and he's like, let me get some champagne.
Yeah, they're fooling around. They're listening to Marvin Gaye.
Uh-huh. And Frances McDormand is like, Marvin Gaye.
So Frances McDormand plays Diane Keaton's sister. Which, like, at at this point in time, like, Frances McDormand had already done Fargo.
Yeah, like, she Frances was McDormand like so is famous.
She's a leading lady, and she plays the fucking sister who probably has 10 minutes of screen time total.
She's the Judy Greer in this
in
movie.
In a Nancy Myers movie. Like, what is happening? I fucking love her. But, like, this is the first movie I had ever seen Frances McDormand in. Because cut to, let's rewind to 2003. I'm 8 years old.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I've never even heard of fucking Fargo.
You're stunning.
So I'm watching Something's Gotta Give.
Of course you are.
And I'm like, who is this lady? Only to come to find out later, she's an incredibly famous actress.
Yes, she's a Meryl. She's a Meryl.
She's a fucking Meryl. And she plays Diane Keaton's sister.
Who has, like, again, like 10 minutes of screen time. Mm-hmm. And she, like, slaps Diane Keaton's ass during Marvin Gaye. She's like, Marvin Gaye, slap, slap. And Diane Keaton's like, oh my goodness, Frances McDormand.
She does, I think, though, like, her character is really, really fun in the, like, in almost like the exposition portion of the movie.
Right.
Where they're, like, explaining the dynamics, explaining all of the character backgrounds.
Right, right, right.
Because she's the one who is pushy enough to ask questions.
Right.
And she's pushy enough to go, like, Jack Nicholson, what the fuck are you actually about?
Right.
And then you find out, which without that information, he would just seem like an asshole the whole time.
A nasty asshole. You nasty man. It's just so fucking funny because Jack Nicholson plays a character in this film who's, like, very set in his ways, mm-hmm. Which, you know, when does he not? That's his brand.
That's his brand.
And he's very, like, fucking set in his ways. And I never thought, at least, like, the first time I ever watched this movie, I didn't really know what it was about because I, too, was a youngin' when I first watched this movie. Mm-hmm. I think I was, like, 9 or something when I popped it in from Blockbuster. May it rest in peace.
Rest in peace, Blockbuster.
But I truly did not understand that this movie was about, like, two old people, quote-unquote mm-hmm. old people falling in love. I was like, oh, like, this is about him and, like, the daughter and, like, maybe the mom will, like, be accepting or not. Yeah. Like, I thought that was the whole vibe.
Yep.
Because Jack Nicholson, from the very beginning, is incredibly set in his ways, and you don't ever for a second believe that he is capable of loving an older woman. Like, it's impossible. No. Or being with, or having sex with, or hanging out with. Like, it's just not his MO.
Yeah.
Period. End of discussion. And the fact that he's a fucking rap god.
He owns Drive-By Records.
Which I'm just like, racist 2003 come through.
Oh, yeah. It's interesting, though. Obviously, I don't know Jack Nicholson because, spoiler, he's not actually he's a close not, friend oh, yeah. of the
in
pod.
Case you guys thought that he was a friend of the pod, in case I was that believable, he's not.
He's not actually.
I've never been to his house. I don't know that he does, like, Pilgrim and Native American sketches when it's Thanksgiving time.
Yeah, I know nothing about who he is as, like, a real person. But if I were to imagine what Jack Nicholson is like in real life, his role in this movie feels closest to what he probably is like.
Yeah.
He just feels like he's having a great fucking time in this mm-hmm. movie, which that kind of makes me... Because I would think, like, why is Jack Nicholson in a Nancy Myers movie? That's not to say that Nancy Myers movies are trash. I love them. But he's a very highbrow actor. And so... him being in this movie, it was kind of a surprise,
mm-hmm.
but it really was just like a chance for him to play,
yeah,
to do something like a different. Little different and yet very close to himself, it seems,
mm-hmm.
and to act opposite Diane Keaton, which is great. I don't think that this is the first movie they had been in together.
I don't think so
but
either.
Them as lovers, as senior citizen lovers, is oh god, it's just so fun.
Oh my gosh, they're. I just want to very quickly talk about, like, their dynamic and their energy. Like, they are so... Their chemistry is impeccable.
It's crazy.
It's like, I can think of no other word other than bombastic. Because, like, I have never, ever in my life up and, like, you know, had seen anyone that age, like, when I was, like, 10, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm a grown now, and I know what the world looks like. but at that point, I was, like, I'd never seen anyone that age, like, play like that and like experience joy in that way, especially not like divorcees and especially not like someone like Jack Nicholson, who at that point in time I had seen in The Shining. I'm like, how does that make any sense?
No, totally.
And I just really quickly wanted to say, like, it really like opened the doors for me on like how people can act.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what age they are.
Yeah.
And I think that specifically like with the story of like an uptight woman who had to sort of like learn to fend for herself again after a divorce.
Yeah.
Like that really made me, it really just like opened my eyes to like a whole new world of like, you know, life isn't just like your 20s. Like that's just not what it is.
No.
It goes far beyond that. And you can find yourself and evolve at any stage of your life. It really doesn't matter.
Yeah. Being shown that falling in love and having fun sex at an older age, like being told that those aren't just young experiences,
mm-hmm.
is really, really important. And it's weird because I think when people think of the film industry, they're like, oh, like it's getting so much more progressive.
Right.
But I think when it comes to age.
Oh, no.
I genuinely think it's a bit regressive.
Yeah.
Because you look back at some of these stories. We talked about it a little bit when we talked about Beaches on the Bette Midler episode.
Mm-hmm.
Like that story would have been 20-year-olds today.
Oh, yeah.
I think today this story would have been 40-year-olds. And in this, it's like a late 50s and then early 60s man.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is almost 20 years ago at this point. And I just don't see those kinds of stories in terms of age coming around anymore. And if I do, it has a more like tragic edge to it.
Right. Which this is just fun.
Yes. Like this it's is just fun.
This is just, it exists in its own bubble of just like fun. And like, here's a glimpse into what mm-hmm. quote unquote dating, because it's not really dating at that point in your life.
No.
Is like. As an older person, like in an older body, like walking around the world through the eyes of like an older soul, like that's just what it is. And a lot of the times, like you would think like, okay, let's just take like how young people have sex or mm-hmm. how young people experience relationships and put it like, and just make them older.
Yeah.
You would think that that's what happened, but that's not what happened. That is not what Nancy Myers did.
No.
She said, let's take those experiences and put them through the lens of an older couple mm-hmm. or like older people that are dating. And like seeing all those like little quirks of you know, Diane Keaton being like, we have to take your blood pressure before we like have sex. It's the responsible thing to do.
Yeah.
And them like not being able to see anything because they need glasses. So
they swap each other's reading glasses.
And like that is the equivalent of like, I don't know, a young person doing something else to that extent. And it's like, it's very cool to see their world not just be like, mm-hmm. okay, let's take a young person's perspective and like put it in just older bodies. Like that's just not what it was. It was truly like, this is the older experience and let's make that fun and let's make that like cool and like let's glimpse into that versus the other thing.
Well, the decision to have the inciting incident of this movie be a heart attack like speaks to Nancy Myers' philosophy about this, you know, all on its own,
mm-hmm.
is that these things happen because someone had a brush with death. Like, and that's not something that a young person can always relate to. I know I sound like silly saying this as a 25-year-old and mm-hmm. being like, young people don't think that way.
But it's true. You think you're invincible.
They don't. Like, I know enough invincible. To think that, like, that would never happen to me right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I just fucking love this movie. I love all of the relationships in this movie. I think a wonderful addition was Keanu Reeves.
To not just have
this kind of, like, young old love story, but also to have the older woman being pursued by this like hot young man. That was just like a really added, like a nice little extra for
and
Nancy.
it's not like The Graduate style. It's no. very like real and like rooted in like, oh, he loves her writing.
Yeah.
And like that's the in. That is what like opens her up to like sort of see him as a potential like suitor or as a potential partner, because they obviously like get kind of engaged at the end, but then don't.
Well, because when he's talking to Jack Nicholson about, like, Jack Nicholson comes in for his checkup, mm-hmm. and Keanu Reeves asks about Diane Keaton, and he doesn't say, like, well, I think she's so hot. He says, well, I find her, like, incredibly fascinating.
Yes.
Which, that's fucking how it should be.
Absolutely.
That's how relationships should be. I mean, obviously, there's an element of finding each other attractive.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But, like, he is so into her mind.
And he's captivated by her talent.
Creatively. Mm-hmm. So it's not creepy.
No, it's not, because you can tell, like, the setup is, oh, he only really sees her abilities. He only sees her talent. And that is the little people that, like, opens up into a window mm-hmm. of him liking her, like, entire person.
Yeah.
But anyway, specifically about Jack Nicholson in this film, he is such a chameleon, because I think that if he truly wasn't this, like, I agree with you when you said, like, this is probably as close to, like, the real Jack Nicholson TM that we'll probably ever see. If he's not like this, I will be incredibly surprised, and I will, mm-hmm. I'm flat out calling him a fucking chameleon, because how do you even, like, get into that fucking place? I don't understand it. I don't get, like, the way he is able to really easily, like, slither into something like that. Like, just some slinky, sleazy guy who is, and they say it in the movie, he's incredibly soulful at times.
Yes.
Like, he just switches immediately and, like, goes into, like, you know, monologuing to Diane Keaton about how beautiful she is and how he, like, there's no one like her. And he's, like, using all these incredible, like, all these incredible words and very, like, different vocabulary to describe exactly the effect that she has on him. Mm-hmm. And, like, I'll be fucking damned if that's not Jack Nicholson IRL at the real Jack Nicholson.
Well, I mean, like, it's just one of those things. Like, I would be impressed either way.
Truly.
Because it's hard to play someone as if they're just yourself.
Right.
But it's also hard to play yourself.
That's true.
When you have decades of experience not playing yourself, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden to be given a role where it's like, just act normal. Like, that's fucking hard.
It's also hard to believably act like your character is cool with everything. Mm-hmm. Like, just look at, like, all of the relationships that specifically Jack Nicholson's character has. He has to be so charismatic that he attracts younger women, mm-hmm. and he has to be so soulful and so experienced enough to be able to, like, go head to head with Diane Keaton's character and mm-hmm. be able to give advice to Diane Keaton's, you know, daughter, and to be able to be, like, at the end of the movie, like, a family man. Like, in order to play all these different roles, you have to come from, like, a place of truth. And I think that Jack Nicholson specifically, like, the way that he sort of, like, handles that and switches from, like, role to role with just within this movie is seamless. You know, I think of that scene where he is, like, talking to Marin, who is, what's her face, Pete, Amanda Pete's character, mm-hmm. who plays obviously the daughter of Diane Keaton, bless, and they're like on the Hampton Beach and like they're breaking up, or like Marin is like, I'm breaking up with him, but then as she starts talking to her mother in the kitchen, she's like, wait, he's a fucking genius, he broke up with me by saying all of these incredible things about how, like, we should, like we were destined to be friends and, like, all of this crap. And in my mind, I'm like, that's so brilliant, because I believe that. I believe that that comes from Jack Nicholson's character, because Jack Nicholson can so seamlessly switch from role to role. He is brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, but and at the same time, he maintains the same sort of, like, blind spots in absolutely. His character. Like, oh my God, that scene outside of the restaurant, one of the most iconic scenes in the movie.
So good.
Where he's on a date with a younger woman, and Diane Keaton happens to be in the same restaurant, and she sees him. And this is after they've had their, like, romantic weekend. This is after they've told each other that they love each other. And he's gone back to the city because he has healed from his heart attack. And she sees him, and she, like, loses it and runs out of the restaurant. He runs after her. And he's just, like, as in tune as he is with women in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. this is the area that he is not.
He's totally blind.
And he says, like, I'm not good at being a boyfriend. And she's just, like, fucking done.
She's over it.
She's just like, how, at our age, how can you think that that's what I was ever asking you to be? Like, you're insane.
You're
and
an idiot.
She's like, this is real, genuine love. And then she does it. Oh, God. She kisses him.
Ugh.
And then she says, like, this is heartbroken.
And she just, like fish flops into the fucking cab.
And then she just gets into a cab and goes away. And he has an anxiety attack. And... like, as old as he is, as experienced as he is, as seasoned as he still doesn't fucking know that, like, this is what happens when you have genuine feelings for someone, because he's never had genuine feelings for someone.
Exactly. He's always kept people at arm's length.
Mm-hmm.
And just the fucking montage of fucking Diane Keaton crying and sobbing and writing her play.
It's so good.
It's so good.
And then she'd, like, start laughing for a second and then all of a sudden start
crying.
It's so good.
What a brilliant movie.
You gotta watch this movie. There's nothing bad about this movie.
There's nothing bad. You know what? Don't look at the Rotten Tomatoes score. Don't look at any of it.
No, just watch the movie. You'll enjoy it.
You'll love it. You'll watch it and be like, fuck yeah. Like, Jack Nicholson, Diane Keaton, sign me the fuck up.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Hamptons, baby. It's in the city, baby. They ended in Paris, baby.
Oh, yeah.
There's a baby at the end.
There is a baby. That's the only thing about this movie that doesn't make sense, is that timeline.
I know, the timeline.
It's only been
wild.
6 months since him and Maren broke up, and she's married with a baby.
She must have gotten pregnant, like, at her honeymoon. She must have, like, gotten married after meeting someone for 3 months.
They must have gotten married real quick and then immediately gotten pregnant.
100%.
Yeah.
We stan.
Anyway. So I guess that's Jack Nicholson for now.
That's Jack Nicholson for now.
Yeah.
That's the real Jack. That's going to be at the real Jack Nicholson. Instagram.com/the real Jack Nicholson.
So, Monica.
Yes.
What have you dabbled in?
I have dabbled in soliloquisms with my skull.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's Halloween. I thought I would give a Halloween dabble. I am going as Hamlet this year.
That's cute.
It's just
me. And by
me.
Going, you mean sitting in your house?
Yeah, my kitchen mostly.
Okay.
And that's about it.
That's good.
It is me, Skull. And it is I, Bones. And we together, we are Skull and Bones. And also, Mr. Hamlet. And smaller Hamlet the Junior.
Oh, boy.
What have you dabbled in?
Not Hallows a whole Eve? Lot, but I'm going to do a shameless plug here for a moment.
Ooh, is it spooky? Is it Halloween themed?
It is, actually.
Incredible.
So you can hear my voice on another podcast called Lucid, which my episode came out yesterday, I think.
I think so,
or the day before. Mm-hmm. And... it was co-created by our sound guy, Aaron.
Our sound
and
guy.
My voice is on one of the episodes.
Jessica's voice.
It's a spooky podcast. The episodes are short, like 15 minutes. So you guys should go listen.
Go listen. That's the Lucid Podcast. I think the Instagram is at Lucid Podcast.
Yeah, that sounds right.
enjoy. It's on. I think it's on Spotify and it Apple Podcasts. It's on all of them.
It's
go
on
check them out.
Everything.
Go check it out. Yeah. Woo.
So we also have a question this week.
Oh, who asked this question?
A real live question. So this is from Allison.
Incredible.
And she says, can you walk through your process of how you watch the films you talk about? What's your approach and what do you look for? What are you taking notes on?
Whoa, Allison.
Whoa. So I guess, like, all the steps of the process.
Are you trying to make a podcast and rip our podcast off? Is that what you're asking this question?
So how we pick the films is... how we pick the daddies and how we pick the films is a little arbitrary.
It's also very separate.
It's, yeah. So first we pick the daddy and it's really me and Monica either in the same room or texting going, who do we feel? Like, who feels right?
The honest answer to the question is it is some kind of vibe that we get.
Yeah.
Like, for example, we both adore Meryl Streep.
Yes.
If you are a talented actress and are nearing the same caliber, we will call that actress a Meryl.
Yes.
Meryl Streep is the standard by which mm-hmm. we go about our lives and go about critiquing other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of the times is like with that specific example.
Yeah.
We were like, no, not yet. It doesn't feel right.
Yeah, no, it doesn't feel right. Or when we were deciding to do Sandra.
Right.
We were like, I want someone with a Julia Roberts vibe, like a Girl Next Door in America's Sweetheart mm-hmm. vibe, but not Julia Roberts.
Yeah, yeah. So I will argue that it is not arbitrary because we do make a very conscious...
There is thought.
We do make a very conscious decision about why mm-hmm. we should do specific daddies, why certain people should be going next. Like if we do someone really, like really big or really white, we would mm-hmm. love to like mix it up yeah. and make sure that we have a little bit of diversity with each episode while also staying true to what we actually feel like we want to talk mm-hmm. about. Because at the end of the day, if we do someone that we don't want to talk about, we don't do it.
Yeah.
Like even if we get close enough, like, you know, to the edge of the Y or to the,
we've canceled daddy's day of.
Yeah. Day of. We'll like sit down and be like, you know what? This doesn't feel yeah, right.
Just it's just not the time.
And because we turn around this podcast pretty dang quickly, we yeah. kind of just really go with the flow. And if there's any sort of like person, any daddy that really has impacted us for the week, mm-hmm. we'll tell each other and be like, we have to do this person.
Yeah.
So that's choosing the daddy. In terms of choosing the movie, that is a lot less vibey than choosing the daddy.
That's it. Well, first we just kind of go off of the first three that we think of, which mm-hmm. tend to be the biggest because
or the biggest or the most niche. Or sometimes the, yeah. it's like it's the biggest like pendulum swing ever.
Yeah. So we'll just like pick the three that we think of and then go through their filmography and go like, is there any like massive blind spot? Because mm-hmm. like, on the one hand, this podcast is just why we like mm-hmm. the actors mm-hmm. And the work that we like them for. But at the same time, you can't fucking talk about, I don't know, like, who's a good example, Monica?
I guess, I mean, a good example would just be Jack Nicholson. You can't talk about Jack Nicholson without talking about The Shining.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah. Like we said, well, like we mentioned earlier, there are millions of movies, not millions, but like there are so many movies that we could talk about, yeah. When it comes to Jack Nicholson. Or another really good example is like Tom Hanks, right?
Sure.
We could, you know, when we eventually do the Tom Hanks episode, which, you know, the vibe has to be right.
It do.
Once again, you cannot talk about Tom Hanks without talking about Forrest Gump.
Yes.
Period.
Exactly.
End of discussion. Whether or not you like that movie, whether or not like we necessarily like feel very strongly about that movie, which we do.
Yeah.
It's fucking good. We still have to talk about it because it is like a career maker.
Yeah.
Because our podcast focuses on the daddy, right? Mm-hmm. We focus on the actor. We focus on the actress. We focus on the person in front of the camera and oftentimes behind the camera. And that sole individual person, if they have something that is incredibly significant to their career,
yeah, like what really put them on the map,
then we have to do it. Obviously, most of the time, it's movies that we love.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not. And sometimes yeah. we have to dig and find things that we appreciate about that movie and about their performance. And we talk about it anyway.
Like Brendan Fraser in The Mummy.
Exactly. Which is another incredible, incredible example of yeah. like how we choose the movies. Of course we had to do The Mummy.
Yeah.
Of course we did.
Exactly.
And then we got to choose much more niche performances by him, which made us happy. It's a win-win all around for everyone. Yeah.
So we just take those like initial like knee-jerk decisions and we put them through a filter of like, what are we missing that we have to do?
Yeah.
And if there's too many that we have to do, then it becomes a two-parter.
Or
if their career is so long or so expansive over genres and years, then of course we'll separate it out a little
absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely. Not only that, but you know, to sort of like wrap up like how we choose the movies, mm-hmm. we also like tend to be very selective with the kinds of movies if they were made during a time period or if they were made through a lens that we do not personally agree with.
Sure.
We really try not to do those kinds of movies.
Yeah.
Like if, for example, if Jack Nicholson had come out with like a weirdly racist film.
we probably wouldn't have done it.
No, I mean, there are movies that we didn't do. Oh, like when we did Sandra Bullock, we didn't talk about The Blind Side.
Yeah, we didn't talk about The Blind Side. Why? We released that episode really close to, you know, all of the Black Lives Matter protests, mm-hmm. and they're protests that, like, you know, I've been to, and it's a cause that, like, we believe in.
Yeah.
Generally, like, we think that
Black people should, I don't know, matter.
So it's really difficult to talk about, you know, a white savior movie in that mm-hmm. way when the world has changed so rapidly and we no longer believe in that movie anymore. Yeah. And if we don't believe in that movie, we can't openly talk about that movie.
Yeah, because it's not like her performance is bad or that the movie itself is a bad movie. It's just a white savior movie. It's overdone. It's not important anymore.
It's not important. And why would we want to talk about something that we don't believe in and we yeah. don't think is relevant anymore? And yeah. that's tea.
And then I guess what do we look for? What do we take notes on?
Everything, anything.
Anything we notice that's impressive. I mean, it helps that Monica and I are both actors, or were both actors, have done acting.
And Jessica is still an actor. Call her up. I'm kidding.
That helps. I studied theater in school. I mm-hmm. studied film to an extent in school. So, like, you know what an acting choice looks like, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and you know what a directing choice looks like if we're yeah. talking about a filmmaker daddy. And I think that a lot of it just comes from, like, us being inherently creative people, mm-hmm. whether or not, so, like, the whole, like, hook of the podcast is like, we love films, and if you didn't go to film school and you love films too, then you like this. That's, like, the whole hook. And the reality is we did not go to film school. No. And a lot of our opinions are just that, our opinions. But I would strongly argue that our opinions do hold some merit because we do pay attention.
Yeah.
And we are incredibly passionate about these films. We watch them every single week.
Yeah. Oftentimes we're watching 6 movies a week.
And that shit is crazy. And we pay attention. And like Jessica said, we do have backgrounds in the arts. You know, we have backgrounds in performing arts. We have backgrounds in directing. We have backgrounds mm-hmm. In film. Like we know what to look for, and we know what looks good, whether or not we're good at it.
Yeah.
Whether or not we execute it very well.
It's also just like when you're watching something, you know when you enjoy it and when you don't. It's just taking that feeling and taking it one step further and going, why?
Yeah. And I also just encourage you to, you know, the next time that you watch a movie, instead of just like watching it for entertainment purposes or for pleasure, mm-hmm. maybe try and like see what you can get out of that movie, mm-hmm. performance wise or directing wise, or like what, pick something in the movie to focus on and try it. Like, I'm certain that any of you could do this 100%.
Yeah.
Like whether you do it, like whether you journal it, or you like you talk about it with a friend. Like if you find yourself talking about films at like parties with friends, mm-hmm. This is what we're doing. We're just doing it in podcast form.
Yeah.
And for some reason, some people listen.
Yeah. You all have favorite movies, and you all have favorite actors and filmmakers. A lot of you. There are reasons why you like those things. It just, you know, take your thought process a little bit farther and just start thinking of like, okay, well,
why?
I like this character. Yeah. Do I like them because of how the other characters relate to it? Do I like them because of the choices that they're making, et yeah. cetera, et cetera?
A lot of it is just like asking the question of why.
Yeah.
Why do we like specific things? Like, why is the performance so captivating? Mm-hmm. Why is the filmmaking the way that it is? And you too can be pretentious asshole. Which is obviously the opposite of what we ever want. That we honestly, like, truly, we'll listen to a lot of, and we don't actually listen, but like you listen to a lot of, you know, of these like film bros talking about like film stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is the exact opposite of what we want. Like if you love talking about movies and if you feel passionate about the art of filmmaking and mm-hmm. you just adore acting, you adore watching people do it, like talk about it. You shouldn't feel like it's something that is only reserved to people who quote unquote know what they're talking about, because you could know what you're talking about and also be talking completely out of your ass. Like, that's a thing.
Yeah, like I think even if you know one film really well, your opinions on that film are really valid.
They matter.
You don't need to know the other films of that fucking filmmaker in order to have a valid opinion about something or a valuable opinion about something.
Yeah, bro. So if you like Jaws, go for it.
Go for it. Talk about Jaws.
Talk about Jaws.
I get that's a really long answer to this question, but it, I mean, that's our whole process.
That's it. Yeah, that's it was really, we were playing kind of fast and loose with the with the selection process.
Yeah.
But we are, the only thing that I will say to sort of like end this,
yeah,
to finish this, we're very intentional always. Yeah, yeah. It's never as arbitrary as we jokingly make it seem. And that's just sort of the last thing that we'll leave you with.
Yeah, a lot of planning does go into this.
Many plans.
Because we want you to enjoy it.
Enjoy.
All right. Well, that's Jack Nicholson. As always,
don't sue us, Daddy Favreau.
Goodbye.
Happy Halloween.
Oh, yes. Goodbye.
Goodbye.